I want you to picture just a simple piece of paper. Like it's sitting there on a table in this perfectly silent studio in Whittier, California.
Right.
And let's say it's September 2024. The paint has barely even dried yet.
It's completely fresh, like a brand new creation pulled straight from the artist's current headspace.
Exactly. But then, just a few weeks later, that exact same piece of paper crosses an entire ocean. It ends up hanging under the bright, cosmopolitan lights of a gallery at the Paris Art Expo.
Oh, wow. That's quite a jump.
Right. You've got people from all over the world walking by, stopping, and leaning in to study it. And if you were standing in that pristine, quiet European gallery, you might expect this piece to be, I don't know, a sweeping landscape of the French countryside.
Yeah, or maybe a chic minimalist portrait, because the environment kind of sets an expectation, right?
Definitely.
You are in a refined space, so you anticipate a refined, maybe subdued subject matter.
But the story that is actually soaked into the fibers of this specific paper has absolutely nothing to do with California, and it certainly has nothing to do with autumn in Paris.
Audible.
Instead, it is a direct, like completely unfiltered portal to the noisy, sweaty, revolutionary streets of Cali, Colombia in the 1960s.
It's such a wild juxtaposition.
It really is.
Yeah.
We are looking at a watercolor titled Miracoli, which was created by the artist Yarrow Duke. And it's a 15 by 22 inch painting of an old corner restaurant.
Just a local spot.
Yeah, you see these red brick walls, a little white balcony, an awning with a few people chatting underneath it, and a couple of classic cars parked out front.
It is a massive, almost jarring contrast. I mean, you're standing a quiet gallery in France, looking through a window into this tropical urban pressure cooker.
Yeah.
And if you were just walking quickly through that expo, you might glance at it and think, oh, it's just a quaint architectural study.
Like a nice vintage postcard or something.
Exactly, a postcard of a bygone era.
But today, we're doing a deep dive into an intensely transparent, almost vulnerable essay that Duke wrote analyzing his own piece.
And it turns out this painting of an ordinary soda fountain actually operates as a treasure map.
A treasure map, yeah. I love that way of putting it.
Because it reveals the architectural incubator of a massive Latin American counterculture movement.
It really forces us to look at how world-changing cultural shifts, like the city of Cali transforming into the undisputed global capital of salsa, they do not start in sterile corporate boardrooms.
No, they definitely don't.
They start in these highly specific, fiercely local spaces.
Right. And to understand how a seemingly simple image of a restaurant captures such immense cultural energy, we actually have to start with the literal physical construction of the artwork itself.
The physics of memory,
Yes,
basically.
the physics of memory. In his essay, Duke is hyper-specific about his materials.
He is. He specifically cites using 640-gram cold-pressed Arches paper and Daniel Smith watercolors.
Which, you know, without turning this into a technical lecture on paper manufacturing,
Please don't.
I won't, I promise. But we do need to understand the physical reality of those choices. For anyone who has ever dabbled in watercolor, you know that the weight or the grammage of the paper dictates everything.
Right.
Standard watercolor paper is around 300 grams. If you hit that standard paper with heavy, repeated layers of water and pigment, it buckles.
It just warps
Yeah,
completely.
it creates a fragile, ethereal, wavy landscape that feels like it might just blow away in the wind.
But 640-gram paper is a totally different beast. That isn't even just paper anymore.
No.
It is essentially rigid cardboard. It is a structural wall.
And because it's cold pressed, it has a really rough, heavily textured surface. It is full of these microscopic valleys and peaks.
So when Duke applies those highly pigmented watercolors, the color doesn't just wash over the surface.
Exactly. It sinks into the crevices, it anchors itself.
He isn't just painting a red brick wall, he is literally simulating the construction of one. He's sculpting the roughness of the city directly onto the fiber, drop by drop. I mean, he needed a material that wouldn't disintegrate while he was building this heavy, gritty urban landscape.
And this brings us to a crucial concept Duke mentions in the text, which is the symbolic force of the scene.
Okay, unpack that a little.
While watercolors are historically associated with delicate, fading memories, you know, a hazy sunset or a soft floral arrangement.
Something light and airy.
Right. But by making these highly specific, heavy-duty material choices, Duke creates a structure that feels aggressively real and touchable. It establishes a real sense of physical permanence.
You literally feel like if you ran your hand across the painting, you'd scrape your knuckles against that brick.
Yes. And because of that literal physical weight, The painting immediately communicates sociological waves.
That makes total sense. Like, think about the heavy permanent buildings in your own city. The century-old libraries or those big old stone train stations.
They command respect.
They really do.
Yeah.
And even if you grew up in Paris or Buenos Aires and have never even set foot in Colombia, you intuitively recognize the social gravity of this corner in Miracali just by looking at it.
You recognize it as a place where a community breathes.
And if the paper serves as a structural anchor, the details in the painting actually serve as temporal anchors.
Yeah, you can really see it in the vintage 1960s cars parked out front.
Right. There's a white sedan and a green sedan with these massive, heavy chrome bumpers. And Duke explicitly warns against viewing this as a superficial, nostalgic postcard.
He does.
Those cars ground us in the 1960s, which was a period of explosive, brutal transformation for Cali.
It was a time of incredibly rapid urbanization. People were migrating to the city in droves. Traditional ways of life were colliding with rapid modernization.
The social fabric was stretching to its absolute limits.
The youth of the city were desperately searching for an identity that made sense of all this chaos.
Which is interesting because when we hear the word counterculture, we usually imagine massive crowds, right?
Yeah, totally.
We picture thousands of people taking over the streets with protest signs and megaphones. But Miracali suggests that the real genesis of a revolution is much more intimate.
How do you mean?
Well, think of the 1970s Silicon Valley garage. You had these kids in a dusty, cramped space soldering circuit boards, and they basically accidentally invented the modern digital world.
Oh, I see.
Miracali was the Silicon Valley garage of Columbia in the 60s.
That is a great analogy. But instead of soldering computer chips, the university students and artists and bohemian dreamers sitting at those tin tables were fusing ideas and poetry and rhythm.
They were inventing a global sonic identity.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the global capital of salsa wasn't declared by some government committee handing down a mandate.
Definitely not.
It was hammered out over watered-down coffee at tables exactly like these.
And Duke introduces a truly fascinating architectural concept in his essay to explain why this specific corner was the perfect laboratory for that movement.
Right, the visual hinge.
Yes, he calls the corner of the building a visual hinge, a bisagra visual.
Okay, wait, I need to push back on this a little bit.
Go for it.
Are we over-intellectualizing an awning here? Like, it's a roof over a sidewalk. How does the geometric shape of a corner restaurant dictate the cultural evolution of an entire city?
It does sound academic at first, but the mechanics of it are actually incredibly practical. Think about what a hinge actually does on a door.
It swings.
Well, yeah, but it connects to rigid, immovable things and allows for dynamic movement between them. In urban design, you have a constant tension between the public space and the private space.
Oh, like the street versus the living room.
Exactly. The street where those cars with the chrome bumpers are parked is entirely public.
Right.
It's rigid, it's fast, and it's completely anonymous. You don't just stop to share your deepest artistic ideas in the middle of traffic.
No, you get run over.
Right. And on the other extreme, you have your private home. It's safe and intimate, but it's isolated, it's stagnant.
You aren't interacting with the pulse of the city from your bedroom.
Exactly. So the Terrace of Miracali is the space in between.
It is the hybrid space.
It is. Nestled into the corner of the building and protected by that awning, it creates a semi-private sanctuary. It acts as the visual hinge.
Okay, I'm tracking now.
It physically protects the group sitting at the table, giving them the psychological safety and intimacy needed to debate radical politics or share new musical rhythms.
But simultaneously, because it has no walls, it keeps them completely exposed to the chaotic energy of the public street.
Yes. So they are insulated, but not isolated.
They can literally hear the exhaust of the buses, the shouts of the street vendors, the rhythm of the pedestrians.
The space actually funnels the raw, sweaty energy of the street directly to the tables.
That's incredible.
The artists absorb that public chaos, refine it through their art at the table, and then project those revolutionary ideas right back out into the city. The building itself is basically a machine that regulates the social climate.
It's an acoustic and cultural trap.
Huh?
It catches the vibe of the city, concentrates it under the awning, and lets it ferment.
Ferment is the perfect word.
That makes perfect sense. And notice how Duke frames this machine visually.
Mm-hmm.
He doesn't paint it from eye level, like you're just a pedestrian walking by.
No, he doesn't.
And he doesn't paint it from a bird's eye view looking down, which would make the people look small and insignificant.
He paints the scene from a slightly low angle, looking up at the restaurant.
Right.
And in visual storytelling, that upward perspective grants authority to the subject.
He is taking an ordinary, everyday soda fountain and elevating it to the status of a civic temple.
A monument to the counterculture.
Yeah, but a temple is nothing without its congregation, which brings us to the people sitting at those tables. When you look at the painting, the first thing that hits you about the overall vibe is the sensory thermometer of the palette.
The colors are intensely deliberate.
Duke uses this incredibly warm, palette-saturated brick reds, deep burning ochres. There are no sterile grays or icy blues to cool you down.
None.
You can practically feel the tropical heat radiating off the 640-gram paper. You can literally feel the sweat on the backs of the people crowded under that awning.
It is a sensory tool designed to pull you out of an air-conditioned art gallery and drop you straight into the physical reality of the tropics.
The atmosphere is thick.
It's almost oppressive, but in a way that forces interaction.
Right.
Because when it's that hot and you're sharing that much space, you just have to engage with the people around you.
But here is where I have to admit, I got a little, I don't know, frustrated when I really started studying the piece.
Why is that?
Well, we've established that this is the birthplace of a cultural revolution. This is the spot where the heavy hitters of art, literature, and music were sitting around debating the future.
Right.
So naturally, you want to zoom in. You want to see the specific faces of the poets. You want to see the visionaries who invented these salsa rhythms.
Of course you do.
But when you look closely at the figures sitting at the tables,
there are no faces.
They're completely featureless. They are just anonymous shapes, like a blur of color, roughly resembling a human form. And I just thought, why wouldn't you highlight the specific heroes of the movement? Why not give credit to the individual geniuses who made Cali the capital of salsa?
It's a completely natural reaction. You want to search for historical figures. You want to put a face to the history.
Exactly.
But Duke's brilliance really lies in denying us that satisfaction.
How so?
In his essay, he refers to these anonymous figures as collective presences.
Collective presences.
Let's consider the alternative. If Duke had painted highly detailed, recognizable faces, the watercolor would have instantly shrunk in scope.
Right.
It would have become a biographical portrait of three or four specific friends hanging out in 1968.
Oh, I see. It would just be a painting of Juan and Carlos at the cafe.
Exactly. It becomes exclusive. But by leaving the figures entirely anonymous, those silhouettes become a mirror for an entire generation.
Anyone can see themselves in it.
Yes. Any bohemian dreamer, any university student, anyone who ever sat at a corner cafe in any city trying to change the world can project themselves onto those faceless shapes.
It shifts the focus from individual heroism to a collective generational energy.
It really does.
Like, think about your own memories of college or your early 20s. If you think back to the coffee shop or the dive bar where you and your friends felt like you were solving the world's problems,
right?
You don't necessarily remember the hyper-specific facial features of the people at the table next to you.
Not at all.
You remember the feeling of the crowd. You remember the presence of a community.
Because it's not about who specifically was holding the guitar. It's about the fact that an entire generation was humming the same tune.
It's funny, though. While he keeps the people vague and undefined, he actually does the exact opposite with the environment itself.
He really does.
In his essay, Duke actually critiques himself for the intense density of the painting. He talks about how saturated the canvas is with physical details.
The intricate iron railings.
Yeah, and the lush foliage spilling over the balcony, the heavy blinding chrome on the car bumpers, the deep grooves of the bricks. He genuinely worries he might have overwhelmed the viewer with too much visual noise.
It's pretty rare to see an artist dissect their own perceived flaws so transparently.
It is.
He questions if he should have simplified the background, maybe washed out the bricks so the focus remained purely on the awning.
But I want to validate his original choice here. Because that chaotic, overwhelming sensory overload is exactly how human memory actually functions.
Memory is never that tidy.
Right. When we think back to the places that profoundly changed us, we don't remember them in sleek, minimalist, high-definition panoramas. We remember a chaotic jumble of highly specific textures.
We do.
You remember the glare of the sun off a car bumper. You remember the exact rust pattern on a railing you used to lean against.
Or the heat of a brick wall against your shoulder.
Exactly. So by hyper-focusing on the density of the environment while blurring the people, Duke painted the exact texture of how we remember the spaces that shape us.
And your point about the honesty of memory brings us to the most vulnerable and, frankly, the most dramatic part of Duke's essay.
The great lighting debate.
Yes. His deep artistic self-doubt about the lighting of the scene Duke painted Miracoli using a very clear, hard, frontal daytime light.
It is bright, sharp, and totally unforgiving.
The sun is just blasting the facade of the restaurant. But in the essay, he second-guesses himself intensely.
He does.
He wonders if he made a massive thematic mistake. He asks himself if he should have painted the scene with a nocturnal atmosphere, you know, using deep, heavy shadows and dim streetlights.
Which, on the surface, you can understand why he'd think that.
Culturally, when we think of jazz or early salsa or bohemian counterculture, we instantly associate it with the night.
Right. We picture smoky late-night rooms, dim street lamps, secretive shadows.
Because the night is where rebellion is supposed to happen.
Sure.
He worried that the bright daytime light stripped away the romance and the mystique of the counterculture.
Well, I have to strongly push back against Duke on his own painting here.
I figured you might.
I just think his doubt is totally misplaced, and his initial instinct to use that harsh daylight was an absolute stroke of genius. Let's look at the alternative.
Okay.
If he had painted the scene shrouded in heavy romantic shadows, the counterculture movement would look like a blurry urban legend.
Right. It would look like a myth that we can't quite touch.
A fairy tale of the 1960s that only existed in the dark.
Exactly.
But by using this clinical, bright, harsh daylight, the painting acts like a camera flash on a crime scene.
Oh, I like that.
It is stark. It leaves absolutely nowhere for the history to hide. It says, hey, look at this. This isn't a rumor.
And if we look at the medium itself, contrasting this bold, harsh lighting against the traditional, soft, romantic style of watercolor gives the piece enormous political weight.
It really does.
That bright light screams, this is not a myth. This really happened. It acts as a shield against forgetting.
It demands historical affirmation rather than just romanticizing a bygone era.
It's refusing to let the past be sanitized into a neat, shadowy aesthetic for consumption.
It's saying, no, the revolution happened right here in the blistering Tuesday afternoon sun next to a green sedan while people were drinking sodas.
And that refusal to romanticize ties perfectly into Duke's ultimate philosophical point, which really serves as the thesis of his entire essay.
Yeah, okay.
He draws a hard, definitive line between passive nostalgia and active memory. He is demanding a critical urban reading of our spaces.
Let's break that down, because those sound like two sides of the same coin, but they lead to very different outcomes. Passive nostalgia versus active memory.
Passive nostalgia is simply sighing for the past.
Okay.
It's walking past an old building, seeing the faded paint, and feeling a vague romantic sadness that things aren't the way they used to be.
It's a passive emotion.
Right. It doesn't ask anything of you, and it doesn't change how you act today. It treats history as a closed book.
It's the feeling of buying a vintage postcard and just, you know, putting it in a drawer.
Precisely. Yeah. Active memory, on the other hand, is looking at those exact same red bricks and recognizing them as the structural foundation of who we are right now.
Wow. It's understanding that the freedoms we have, the music we listen to, the cultural identity we celebrate, none of that just magically appeared.
It was built.
It was built by real people in real spaces.
Right.
Active memory recognizes that cultural leaps, like a city finding its global voice and becoming the epicenter of salsa, are not designed in sterile corporate boardrooms by executives.
They're cooked over tin tables with watered-down coffee.
Exactly. Active memory recognizes that the architecture of our daily lives actively shapes our future.
So what we've really done in this deep dive is take a simple 15 by 22 inch piece of heavy paper and proven that an ordinary paint peeling 1960s corner with a simple awning secretly operated as the laboratory for a global sonic movement.
It wasn't just a place to grab a soda and get out of the sun.
It was the visual hinge of a revolution. It provided the exact ratio of safety and exposure needed for a generation to find its voice. The physical space itself demanded interaction. It trapped the energy of the street, and the anonymous collective presence of the people who filled it answered that call, changing the cultural landscape forever.
They didn't need a pristine gallery. They just needed a corner.
They really did.
Which leaves us with a thought that I really want you to mull over. Tomorrow, or the next time you walk outside on your regular commute, I want you to look closely at your own neighborhood.
Try to look past the routine.
Right. Look past the places you just walk by without a second thought. Ask yourself, what noisy, chaotic cafeteria, what ordinary public plaza, or what ignored paint-peeling street corner in your city is currently acting as a visual hinge?
It's a pretty powerful thought. The history of tomorrow is currently sitting at a cheap table, completely exposed to the street, entirely unnoticed by the people walking by.
Where is the laboratory hiding today, incubating the cultural revolutions that the world will be celebrating in 60 years? The next global movement might literally be brewing under an awning right down your street.
It just might be.
And on that note, we want to say a huge thank you for joining us on this exploration of Mirakali and the heavy weight of local spaces. Keep your curiosity alert. Keep questioning the everyday corners around you. And we can promise you, you will never look at your city's architecture the same way again.